The decadent state of religion at the opening of the 18th century. In the 16th century, England had experienced the Protestant Reformation. In the Protestant Reformation, the Church had returned to the Bible from the errors and follies of unreformed tradition, many of which were still embraced by the Church of Rome. Returning to the Bible had meant returning to the canon and text of the Bible and to the authority of the Bible, and making this the Church's guide in the message it preached and in the way it led its life, both corporately and individually. The Book of Common Prayer and the 39 Articles of Religion became the Church's standards, both pioneered by Thomas Cranmer in Edward VI's reign and both based upon the Bible. After Mary Tudor's attempt to undo the Reformation, it was re-established by Queen Elizabeth, whose long reign lasted till 1603. On Elizabeth's death, unmarried and childless, her heir was a member of the Stuart family, who was already monarch of Scotland. Both countries now had a Protestant religious settlement, Presbyterian in Scotland and Episcopal in England, and it is said that things could not continue in England as they had done under Elizabeth, when the monarch, the national church and Parliament had cooperated fairly well and Roman Catholicism had been kept firmly under control. Sadly, however, a hopeful beginning under James I developed into a turbulent attempt under his son Charles I to establish a regal despotism, with no real prospect of an effective check from church or parliament. This led to rebellion against the king and an attempt to change the national church to conform to a non-episcopal Puritan pattern similar to what existed in Scotland. Following the rebellion, the king was unlawfully put to death, and government fell into the hands of Cromwell and his military associates. But in 1660, 11 years after the death of Charles and 2 years after the death of Cromwell, in the vacuum which followed, Charles's son was invited to return from France and succeed to the throne as Charles II. And much of the previous pattern of national and church life came back with him. Puritanism, however, became unfashionable, and the court became for a time notoriously immoral. Under the 1662 Act of Uniformity, passed early in Charles II's reign, the prayer book was restored, together with a more stringent requirement of episcopal ordination than hitherto. Another change, though without a variation of the formularies, was the widespread acceptance of the Dutch novelty of Arminianism, which had been firmly rejected by the Anglican delegates to the Synod of Dort, 1618 to 1619, and which was hardly consistent with Article 17 of the 39 Articles. The Arminian view was that God chose people for salvation on account of their foreseen faith. Though the Church of England was a Protestant church, Charles II was very sympathetic to Roman Catholicism, and his brother and successor James II was an undisguised convert to Rome, who campaigned to make the Church of England follow suit. It was not at that time thought impossible, even if far from ideal, to have a Roman Catholic supreme governor of a Protestant church like the Church of England. But the attempt of James II to make the Church of England follow his example and itself return to Roman Catholicism convinced people of the great dangers of this divergence. Consequently, William of Orange, the husband of Mary, one of James's Protestant daughters by his earlier marriage, was asked to come over in 1688 and help settle the problem. And when, on his arrival, James fled the country, William and his wife were invited to be king and queen, jointly and equally, as William III and Mary II. Oaths of allegiance to the new monarchs were required from the bishops and clergy, but this caused conscientious problems for many, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Sancroft, because King James, to whom they had already sworn an oath of allegiance, was still alive. The non-jurors, those unable in conscience to swear the new oaths, were deprived of their posts and replaced. But some of them continued to minister to like-minded individuals and congregations, and some of their bishops consecrated bishops to succeed them. So a schism arose, which continued for nearly a century. James had a son and a grandson by his new Roman Catholic wife, and these became the leaders of the unsuccessful Jacobite rebellions of 1715 and 1745. James's other Protestant daughter by his previous marriage was Anne, who had married George, Prince of Denmark, and Anne succeeded William and Mary as queen. In the 17th century, partly prompted by the contemporary advances of natural science in England and with the formation of the Royal Society in 1663 and the epoch-making discoveries of Sir Isaac Newton, 1642 to 1727, a new school of thought arose in the Church of England alongside the familiar High Church and Low Church alternatives, under the title of Latitudinarianism, or Broad Church. It laid great stress on reason and morality, but less stress than before on doctrine. The Latitudinarians believed in God, but they considered that belief in God was natural, and some of them, known as deists, thought that belief in God did not commit them to the full doctrine of God set forth in the Christian creeds. So Arianism raised its head again, and the new term, Unitarian, became current. When in 1689 the Toleration Act was passed to relieve the restrictions on nonconformist worship, Roman Catholics and Unitarians were excluded from its mild provisions as being too extreme in their views or policies, and they had to wait until later times before finding similar emancipation. That doughty Protestant church historian, Dr. Sidney Carter, when summing up his book, The English Church in the 17th Century, 1909, and looking forward to the 18th century which followed, drew attention to the vast amount of work that was done after the restoration of the monarchy in the building, restoring, and beautifying of cathedrals and parish churches all over the country. Also, he drew attention to the hospitable reception given to the distressed Huguenots, exiled from France through the revocation in 1685 of the Edict of Nantes, which had existed for their protection. Also, too, to the formation of the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge in 1698, and of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in Foreign Parts in 1701. And to other educational, ethical, and evangelistic initiatives in the same period. Elsewhere in the church, however, there was a neglect of the doctrines of saving grace and a lack of religious zeal, for which the emphasis on reason and moral conduct was no compensation. It was the ministry of Whitfield and Wesley and their associates which would be needed to supply this lack in the course of the 18th century. The voluminous Victorian classic by Abbey and Overton, The English Church in the 18th Century, 1878, gives a full account of the problem and how, in God's providence, it was approached. the royal family in the 18th century. Queen Anne had many children, but they all died before their mother. So, in accordance with a previous decision of the government, when she died in 1714, the throne passed to her nearest Protestant heir, George, the Elector of Hanover, who was great-grandson of King James I. The old pretender, son of James II, also had a claim to the throne, but that he was a Roman Catholic, and the same applied to his son, the young pretender, after he was born in 1720. The non-jurors had sworn oaths of allegiance to James II and his heirs, and these were his heirs, but they were not Protestants, as the law now required. So after the old pretender died in 1766, and the young pretender died without legitimate issue in 1788, the non-jurors were freed from their obligations and were able to swear the oaths to the Hanoverian monarch, who by that time was George III. Church life in the 18th century. In the Church of England, church-going was the normal practice, at least on Sundays. And much the same was true among nonconformists. The prayer book was the Anglican guide, supplemented by metrical psalms, the forerunners of hymns, for which there was the old version produced by Cernhold and Hopkins at the Reformation, and the new version produced recently by Tait and Brady. There were a small number of standard tunes, usually accompanied by a pipe and fiddle, except where an organ could be afforded, and a few singers to lead the congregation's voices. The minister read the service, while the parish clerk led the congregation in their responses. The Bible, authorized version, was read from the lectern. The Sunday services were morning and evening prayer. Morning prayer might conclude with the litany, and evening prayer with part of the catechism. Holy Communion would follow morning prayer three times a year, or perhaps monthly. In the morning there would also be a sermon, or one of the homilies might be read. A collection would be taken up, either for church expenses or as alms for the poor. The minister's robes, cassock, preaching gown and surplice, were of black and white, and the only touch of colour might be from the hood of his degree. On the walls in the church would be the royal arms and the three texts which everyone needed to learn by heart before being confirmed: the Apostles' Creed, the Ten Commandments, and the Lord's Prayer. The clergy in the 18th century. The clergy were generally people of moral lives and some education, often a university degree. They might be of any of the three schools of thought, high, low, or broad. Their preaching might often reflect the current preoccupation with reason and moral conduct, rather than the doctrines of saving grace or the ideal of religious zeal. Common abuses, such as pluralities and non-residents, and eagerness for higher preferment, would probably have affected the ministries of many of the clergy, and some, no doubt, were negligent and worldly, with little care for their flocks. Theology in the 18th century. Apart from the writings of well-known evangelicals, such as George Whitfield and John Newton, the chief theological works of the century were those of Bishop Joseph Butler, 1692 to 1752, and of Archdeacon Daniel Waterland, 1683 to 1740. Butler's famous 15 sermons are devoted to ethics, and several of Waterland's chief works are concerned with sacramental theology. But in both cases, much of their energies as authors were given to confuting the chief heresies of the time, deism and Arianism. Butler's analogy of religion natural and revealed to the constitution and course of nature, 1736, is an impressive work of apologetics against deism, and Waterland's Scripture Vindicated, 1732, is a refutation of the most admired of deist books, Matthew Tyndall's Christianity as Old as the Creation, or The Gospel, a Republication of the Religion of Nature, 1730. Waterland also struck fatal blows against Arianism, which had been revived in Samuel Clarke's so-called Scripture Doctrine of the Trinity, 1712. To this, Waterland replied in A Vindication of Christ's Divinity, 1719, and subsequent works, in which he showed that Arianism was contrary to Scripture and the Fathers, and that no one holding Arian opinions could sincerely subscribe to the Anglican formularies. The 18th century evangelicals. At the time of the Reformation, evangelical was a name applied to those who sought a return to the biblical gospel or evangel, and the name became traditional among many of the Lutherans, who still often prefer to call their churches evangelical rather than Lutheran. After the upheavals and controversies of the 17th century, it was in the 18th century that the name evangelical was applied to a school of thought within the Church of England, who, rather like the Reformers, sought a return to the biblical gospel from contemporary error and unbelief. This school of thought has continued through various vicissitudes up to the present day. Some of these 18th century evangelicals were parish clergy, like four of those whom we shall be commemorating at this conference, Walker, Rowland, Harvey and Romaine, while others, like Whitfield and Wesby, were itinerant preachers. Many of them were Calvinists, while others called themselves Arminians. All emphasized the grace of God, and all saw the need for personal conversion if salvation was to be received. To this extent, they all agreed, and we, I am sure, can agree with them too.